You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
I'm gonna do it tonight. I'm gonna open the window and I'm gonna stick my head out and I'm gonna yell, I'm as mad as hell and I am not taking it anymore. First of all, I'm not Rick Smith, you might have noticed, but not by much. I have some sort of crud in my lungs, and if you're a doctor or, well, are good at playing it, come on by the station and maybe you can listen to my lungs and see if I'm going to die this thing before the show ends. I'm Pat LaMarche. I'm filling in for Rick Smith. He's got the evening off. I get to hang out with Brett, and that is Brett the producer. My favorite thing to do. It's turned into my favorite Friday night event. Congress passed budget cuts in 2011. We all know it as the sequester. They actually didn't pass it. What they did was they, in their incredibly lazy and worthless fashion, abrogated their power, gave over their power to a small committee. And if the committee couldn't, said if Congress can't find a way to get a budget, then we're going to put in effect these automatic, like, circuit breakers that are just going to stop spending money. They're going to stop spending money on all kinds of things. The military, the poor, feeding people, clothing people, putting a roof over their head. And so you guys better get your acting gear, because this small little committee that just did your job for you is going to make you, well, come away with egg on your face. So the sequester went into effect. Because Congress has egg all over its face and they're worthless. And now, 6 months after the sequester, when housing crisis has hit for the poor, our economy's sluggish at best. That would be a compliment to call it sluggish. It turns out that the defense contractors, military contractors, are celebrating record profits. Their stocks are at all-time highs. Right now, the backlog of orders to defense contractors and military contractors is $37 billion. Can anyone say Syria? So we've got all these defense contractors waiting for these $37 billion worth of orders to be placed. If I thought that one Tomahawk missile, if I thought one well-placed slingshot stone would stop the killing in Syria and was not going to kill just some innocent person in Syria, I would not have, I can't even say I wouldn't have a problem. I don't believe it. You know what? I don't know what happened to President Obama. I don't know how much he got for his soul. I'm sure it was too much. It is upsetting. It's disappointing. You don't have to agree with me. 888-520-7425. 888-520-7425 all night long, regardless of who we're talking to. If you want to call up, it'll be like AA for a country addicted to war. It'll be like, this will be your AA meeting where you get to call up and you get to say, hi, I'm a waraholic and I'm addicted to war. But I don't want war anymore. I don't want military action anymore. I don't want 9 and 10 deployments. I don't want this. And you're going to be able to call the show and just express yourself. Hi, I'm Betty. I'm an addict, but I want to get off the junk. I want to stop using war as an excuse. We actually managed in the last regime, you know, the last Bush regime, to wage war and have it not help our economy. We're like idiots. We're like on idiot overload with this stuff. It's absolutely frustrating and it's infuriating. And right now, four times as many members of the House of Representatives are against the Syrian action as are for it. We've got the President of the United States over at the G20 summit lobbying Congress long distance to allow him to drop bombs on a country because a year ago he drew a line in the sand and the line in the sand got too close to his feet. And so because we're afraid no one will believe anything we say again, we have to do it. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You could buy a mirror, United States of America. You're the biggest, toughest, meanest dog on the planet. You've got more military than all the rest of the world combined. You've also got more people in prison. They've got money for Syria, but they don't have money for housing or health care. President Obama is staking his entire reputation on going to war with Syria and having a military action in Syria. That's what he's throwing all of his cachet into instead of, oh, I don't know, how about his signature health care plan? How about making that work? How about anything that isn't killing? Mike Gravel said on the show a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about Chelsea Manning and Mike Gravel's role in saving Daniel Ellsberg's life and the Pentagon Papers. And Senator Mike Gravel said that President Obama would only be remembered as being a black president, that his administration has been so lackluster. Maybe President Obama heard that. Maybe President Obama said, I want to be remembered for something else. I think I'll go and get in a confused situation and start bombing stuff. And by the way, have you heard of Damascus and Aleppo? First of all, you can find them in the Bible, but there are a lot of other places you can find them. You can reference them anywhere you want. They are full of all kinds of multiculturalism. There are like 16 tribes there, but in addition to that, there are every Western European country, culture is represented there. It's hugely multicultural. We're going to just bomb the place? Oh, but we have surgical strikes. I'm just crestfallen. And now on the record. I mean, I've been writing things. I write for different periodicals. I write things. I've also been writing on social media. I don't tweet as well as Brett and those other things that people do. But I have gone on the record now also in the radio waves as they float out to Mars saying I am completely against this action. And all the arguments, the comparing the Syrian issue to World War II, one political science professor said to me, I would have been happy if we had bombed the railroad tracks to Auschwitz. So would I. But we didn't. I would have been happy if we hadn't turned away boatloads of Jewish children. But we did. I would be happy if the United States of America and Standard Oil and Prescott Bush, George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush's family member, hadn't sold Hitler oil. I would be happy if Charles Lindbergh, America's hero, hadn't gone to Germany and come back and been so pro-Germany, so pro-Hitler, that Franklin Roosevelt took away his United States citizenship. I would be really happy if the United States hadn't put such draconian punishments on Germany after World War I that they had nothing but to allow this crazy despot to become their leader. I would love it if we had done things differently in World War II. But we didn't. We didn't bomb the tracks, and we didn't take the children. We just killed a whole pile of innocent people instead of being smart to begin with. Our fingerprints are all over this sarin gas. Our fingerprints are all over all the gas in the Middle East. Our fingerprints are all over the chemical weapons. Russia's fingerprints are there too. And the Soviet Union, when Russia was part of the Soviet Union. But we're the agents of war. Okay, we can't go back in time and stop the stupidity that we've done. Well, let's stop it now. And where's the third option? our options are start bombing people and killing them, or do nothing. Are you? Could we have a leader of the United States who acts like a mommy or a daddy? If your whole choice is feed your children or starve your children, walk them to school or run them over with the car, if those were your choices, wouldn't you try to be a little more creative? Where are the boatloads of doctors that we should be sending there? Where are the antidotes to the gases that we should be sending? Where are the gas masks? Where is the humanitarian effort? I've got a novel approach. Let's talk to Iran. Let's say to Ahmadinejad, you crazy, you know what, you want to have some wheat in your country? You want us to start letting you release a few sanctions? Be a good neighbor. Get a hold of Syria. We'll start talking to you if you start diffusing this situation. Could we try something besides war? Oh, for the love of God. Anyway, and moving on to God, our first guest. We got a great show. I got to tell you that, first of all. Ben Price, you are not going to want to miss. He's on a whole hour tonight as we talk about taking corporations out of capitalism. We're not talking about eliminating capitalism. Capitalism for all the rest of us. You little guy who wants to open a store and sell hot dogs on the street corner. Everybody can have capitalism except the corporations. That way we don't need to deny them personhood. We'll just deny them capitalism. That way we don't have to amend the Constitution and all that stuff. Anyway, Ben Price is going to be with us to explain that. He's the director with Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. He's going to talk about a lot of other stuff. Let's talk about Centralia a little. Do we still need a town on fire in Pennsylvania? Lots of stuff to talk about. We've got Chuck Rossi. He's from Veterans for Peace. Of course, that will be a Syria discussion. And Ben's going to talk a little about Syria, too. And Aja Reynolds, a teacher for social justice, going to talk about whether or not teachers should be armed in our classrooms. Turns out that a state legislator was hell-bent on arming teachers and took a bunch of the teachers to train them on how to use guns, and, well, the legislator shot one of them. So that teacher's not doing too well, but luckily he is still alive. But we're going to talk about that. But first of all, we're going to talk a little bit about theology. God. We're going to talk about God. We're going to talk about people who say that they are prophets sent from God to help you do better with your life. Some of them even tell you exactly how you should think, what you should think. And if you're gay, you're bad. And, you know, HIV's punishment. And Hugo Chavez needs to be assassinated. And so we're going to talk about Mission Congo. Pat Robertson has raised millions of dollars. And, well, guess what? Mission Congo doesn't really exist. Mission Congo was his... He said he started this not-for-profit. It's registered in Virginia to work with the Rwandan genocide. He had video of stretcher bearers running with doctors, reading the Bible to people from the Rwandan, 1994 Rwanda genocides. He showed these videos. They weren't even his videos. They weren't even of people from his group, because his group was actually a diamond mine. And he was raising money to mine diamonds for his own personal wealth. He supported Chuck Taylor, the president of Liberia, even up to and after Chuck Taylor was accused of crimes against humanity in The Hague, because it turns out Pat Robertson, former candidate for president of the United States, Pat Robertson, had a gold mine in Liberia. If you've seen the movie Blood Diamond, you know exactly what we're talking about with Pat Robertson here. And he actually raised money from the faithful to pay for it. And when we come back in just a minute, we're going to talk with Marion O'Brien, who's going to bring us up to speed on what it's like to be the faithful when the self-proclaimed prophets are liars. We'll be right back with more of the Rick Smith Show.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
As the Affordable Care Act is implemented, millions of uninsured Americans will finally get access to health insurance, while many of the most egregious practices of insurance providers will be curtailed. Despite dozens of failed attempts by the GOP to repeal the law and the U.S. Supreme Court upholding it, Republicans in state houses nationwide are still working feverishly to do all in their power to obstruct the law. tremendous time and energy is being spent by Republicans to derail the Affordable Care Act. A little effort is made to actually help more Americans get covered. The health care reform includes navigators to help guide uninsured people through the process of getting covered in the health care exchanges being set up by the federal government. Georgia's Republican Insurance Commissioner Ralph Hudgens recently spoke on a Georgia law that will make it more difficult for navigators to get more people covered under the law.
Let me tell you what we're doing. Everything in our power to be an obstructionist. We have passed a law that says that a navigator, which is a physician in that exchange, has to be licensed by our Department of Insurance.
Nurses for Madison, Wisconsin's Meritor Hospital held a solidarity picket Wednesday to bring the public's attention to their ongoing contract negotiations. The nurses have been working without a contract since April, with one of the major issues being staffing at the hospitals. Mary Mullaney is with SEIU, United Healthcare of Wisconsin.
We're trying to bring our issues to the public, which some of those are staffing. Lately, management has been looking to staff the hospitals with a bare minimum.
Mullaney said the two sides will return to the bargaining table next week, but she isn't hopeful.
We hope to reach a mutual agreement. So far, the hospital hasn't been moving much, and we would like to see, when you bargain, both sides need to move. So I'd like to see the hospital make some movement.
The United Auto Workers and Volkswagen AG are in high-level talks about how the UAW might represent workers at VW's Chattanooga, Tennessee plant. German news media reported the latest round of talks started just before the Labor Day weekend. UAW President Bob King met with Horst Neumann, a VW Human Resources board member in Wolfsburg, Germany. One topic reportedly on the table is creation of a German-style works council for the U.S. plant. Works councils in Germany go back at least to 1920. They work in tandem with management to provide a worker voice in plant operations. VW executives told German media that U.S. labor law requires a union in order to make the Works Council concept work.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
It is time for change. Pat LaMarche here, filling in for Rick Smith. He takes a night off a week pretty much right now, getting his stuff together, and it gives me a chance to, well, pontificate, rant, rave, chat up reality. 1-888-520-7425, 1-888-520. Rick, if you want to chime in on reality. Right now I have Marion O'Brien, Director of Faith Formation and Pastoral Associate of Catholic Parish in New Hampshire. She's also a columnist for Catechist Magazine. And she's my big sister. Hi, Marion.
Hey, Patty. How you doing?
Good. The Patty people.
The Patty people. Yeah.
People that call me Patty.
I know.
I
you're
love
supposed
it.
To be Pat.
When Mom would call and leave me a message, if someone said, someone called for you, Patty, I always knew it was Ma.
Yeah.
Okay, so Pat Robertson's got this Operation Blessings, which he says is a charity to help refugees of the Rwandan genocide. A million people poured into what used to be known as Zaire and started getting cholera, started dying. His supporters started helping. Well, today at the Toronto Film Festival, a documentary has come out made at the behest and with the cooperation of some of the people who were in the videos that Pat Robertson showed of aid relief being delivered. But the aid relief was not delivered by Robertson or his charity. What he actually did, what his charity actually did was it shuttled people back and forth to the diamond mine he owned. And it shuttled, supplies to the diamond mine. And this was a completely for-profit experience. Experiment he was doing there, making millions and millions of dollars. One of the pilots in this documentary that they interviewed said, finally he was so offended by flying around with Operation Blessing on the tail of the plane that he himself painted over it because it was such a lie. And Marion, as a woman and a worker whose job is faith formation, you know, there's like a million questions to ask about this. What does that do to the faithful, number one? And how does a guy get off calling himself a prophet when, you know, Jesus doesn't run background checks? Because, or you can't get to the Jesus has got the background check, but we can't access it.
Well, I tell you what, Pat Robinson doesn't have a corner on being a false prophet. There have been thousands of them over the centuries. So he's just one of many that have been inflicted on people over the centuries. But, you know, after you called me earlier and we talked about this a little bit, you know, I began to think, the command that God gives us in the Bible, in the scriptures, more than any other, and it occurs over 2,000 times in scripture, is to take care of the poor. It is loving your neighbor is one of the cornerstone things that Jesus came and spoke to us about. In fact, probably one of the best known scripture passages comes from the Gospel of Matthew, where Jesus says, whatever you did for the least of these, you did for me. You know, and those who are going to enter heaven are the ones who have helped to take care of the poor.
Oh, my God, I can't imagine a least of me more least than a Rwandan refugee escaping, you know, machete genocide who goes to another country and gets cholera.
Well, that's true. I mean, you think of, you know, the situation there is abominable, of course, but, you know, most of the world's population lives on less than 85 cents a day. And, you know, so the problems of poverty, I mean, you figure the kinds of responsibility that Pat Robinson had being the person in his position, because anyone who belongs to a Christian faith, Christian churches like Pat Robinson's, like the Catholic Church, like the Episcopal Church, Baptist, and all the smaller Christian denominations, they are the ones that, the faithful, the parishioners, the congregants, the members, they're the ones that they all look to give them specific examples of the way to live out this commission that Jesus has given to us from his own mouth. You know, this is what you're meant to do. In fact, the last command that he gives to his disciples in the Gospel of John is to love one another. And to love one another means to have the interest of the other be more important than your own.
Yeah, well, clearly, this is clearly not his goal.
Right. Well, clearly Pat Robinson was more interested, you know, but from what this story looks like, and I've read the articles in the paper, it appears as though the money that he collected from his congregants went to line his own pockets rather than to the people it was intended to do.
And like you said, that's not a surprise. That's not uncommon. And me living in the totally secular world, I'm like really angry at the state of Virginia, because the state of Virginia knew about this 5 years ago and decided not to press charges, which has just allowed Pat Robertson to keep doing it. He was raising money for this charity last year.
Yeah. Well, all of that aside, you take a look at how does this affect the people who first felt that they were participating in the mission of Jesus by giving Pat Robinson money mm-hmm. to feed the poor, to help the poor, mm-hmm. help the Rwandans who were suffering from cholera and these terrible diseases? I have some personal knowledge about the problems that were in the Congo. I worked closely with a missionary priest from the Vincentian Order who had been in the Congo for a number of years, and he was there during the war, you know, and there were times when he would tell me stories about, you know, watching the little children die, and there were tears in his eyes, you know. And after I read the article about Pat Robinson, I thought to myself, those millions and millions of dollars, you know, would have gone to avert the tragedy that this these children were going through, and this priest was a witness to, you know.
Yeah.
there are people, there are faces, there are individuals, and I think I personally don't know how a person lives with themselves knowing that they have diverted those funds that people have given for the purpose of saving lives and lining their pocket with it.
When I spoke to you earlier, you talked about a personal thing that happened where you had a much smaller scale sort of problem where someone had made off with some funds, and the Catholic Church, because the charity was part of the Catholic Church made sure the mission was completed. Now,
right.
What happens when it's something like this, a cult of personality that Pat Robertson is like, he's the God, which, you know, I find really kind of offensive, and I find it offensive that I said it, but he's the person, all the faith stops with him because people have sort of grafted their faith onto him and take his word as truth.
Well, that's certainly correct, and it points up the great responsibility the person has who is a minister, who is a person who leads people in the understanding of what it is that their faith has told them they should be doing. Like, you know, we have great examples. I can't answer for Pat Robertson or for the, you know, like I said, the thousands of other charlatans that have been out there, you know, in the present, and look at the Westboro Baptist Church. You know, there's another example of people who are using scripture to a terrible end. But there is no real answer for people of faith. They're called to be faithful to the message that Jesus has given them. Jesus' mission is to spread his word, which is to love one another and to reach out to those who are poor, who are sick. I mean, you look at all the things that Jesus did when he was here. He helped people who were lame and blind, and he assisted people who struggled with spirituality. All the things that were important to Jesus, even in his own time, he spoke about religious leaders, the Pharisees, who spoke about a spiritual tradition, Judaism, and also altered it for their own benefit. So this is something that Jesus experienced in his own time. It's not new, and it isn't going to stop today because Pat Robertson got caught.
As the director of faith formation, does this make your job harder?
Well, I think when you have a personal relationship with people, like one of the things that I do is I work a lot with young kids, junior high and high school students personally. I mean, as director of faith formation, I would be responsible for the entire program, adults, children, everything. But whenever I did that, I was also immediately involved with the youth, the junior youth, junior high school age kids and teens. And for instance, last year we spent a whole third of the curriculum for the year was concentrating on poverty and homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what we did was we talked
about... You didn't open a diamond mine.
No.
No.
But we did talk about the Catholic Church's teachings of social justice, and we made the kids aware of what the problem was. That's a big part of what we do, is to make them not only aware of what is going on in the world and the struggles that people have, but also, as a person of faith,
all of our United States senators listening daily to the heartbeat of the legislatures and not be passing laws that cost all of us, unquote. Patrick, his opponent, mirrored the same sentiment by saying the following. In the race for lieutenant governor, I was the one who began the conversation about this critically important issue. I unequivocally support the repeal of the 17th Amendment and the restoration of our founders' original intent to have the state legislatures select our United States senators. So that's the contest for lieutenant governor in the state of Texas that's going on right now. And it is focusing on overturning the 17th Amendment and returning control of the choice, the selection of state senators, of a state, United States senators, to its legislature. Be aware, and I don't think we can afford to ignore this, be aware that part of the reason that conservatives, Republicans, want to go this route is because Republicans have been so successful in recent years in gaining and retaining control of state legislatures and state houses. And what they have been effectively able to do is gerrymander districts in such a way that the chances of dislodging them from control of the legislature or control of the state house in the upcoming election become more and more remote. So the fact of the matter is, even though we have in most places a majority of Democrats, the fact of the matter is districts have been redefined in such a way that many of these Republican office holders now represent districts which have been made safe. And the opposition has been piled up in districts which will elect Democrats, non-conservatives, but they are in the minority in most of these places. So the chances of opposition movements emerging within gerrymandered districts in order to topple these current office holders are pretty remote. The shift in sentiment that would make a change like that happen would have to become, would almost be a seismic change. It would be huge. And chances are that's not going to happen. So consequently, because Republicans have been so successful in securing control of state legislatures and governorships, they feel very comfortable in moving for the overturning of the 17th Amendment and returning control of state of state senators to these legislatures, as was in the original Constitution. Because they know in doing that, it's going to give conservatives the opportunity to take control of the United States Senate by taking the power of election away from the people. When you put it this way, it makes what's going on very, very significant and very real. This is not a joke. This is deadly serious political business. Because off in the distance is the reality, not the possibility, but the reality, given what we know about Mark Levin's book and the people who support it, that if additional states go Republican in next fall's election, in the 2014 elections, then it's not going to take too many more before Republicans will control two-thirds of the state legislatures. They already control a majority, 26. So it's not going to require too many more before they have two-thirds. And if they get it, then the Constitution gives two-thirds of the state legislatures the right to call a constitutional convention under the Constitution, Article 5. And Mark Levin's Liberty Amendments lays out what I see as the agenda should such a convention ever happen. And one of the provisions, one of the amendments proposed, is the abolition of the 17th Amendment and returning the choice of United States senators to state legislatures and away from the people. So you might be asking yourself, because I do every once in a while, whatever happened to the idea that when the politicians had control of these decisions, when the politicians were deciding who the United States senators were, it was creating a degree of distrust and popular animus toward the national government. And the thinking was that the only way to make progressivism work on the national level was to get progressives elected to the United States Senate. And the only way to do that was to wrest the power to appoint United States senators from political hacks at the state level and look to the people themselves to elect more forward-looking, more committed, more public servants to the United States Senate. Now, all of a sudden, we're looking at a situation to reverse that and go back to where we were. So if you think about that, people would naturally say, what's going on here? That doesn't seem to make any sense. I would suggest to you that politically it makes all the sense in the world. Because these people pushing for this know well that their agenda on the national level is being throttled by the fact that the Democrats control the United States Senate. And what they are choosing to do is not run conservative candidates against the people that now control the United States Senate. Instead, what they want to do is take the power to re-elect these progressives, these liberals, away from the people, and give that power of appointment to state legislatures which they control. Bottom line, this is a potential revolutionary situation. This is incredibly, incredibly significant and important. I thank Gene for the amendment. For the article on that amendment, on that Texas situation. I had the pleasure last evening to listen to Mark Levin's talk show radio program for about, maybe a half an hour while I was in the car. At first I didn't know who I was listening to, but it didn't take long before I realized who it was. And the conversation was about Muslims, specifically about the difference in the Muslim world between moderates and fundamentalist Muslims. And of course the callers who were calling in were basically saying, where are all of these moderate Muslims that supposedly exist out there? All we ever see and hear from are the fundamentalists. And people were asking questions. And Mark Levin's response was, there's no way that we can definitively answer that question because fundamentalist Muslims don't call programs like mine. They're too busy blowing up buildings. Free speech is alive and well in the United States, folks. Your right to say whatever you want to say is apparently there. And in good shape. I almost ran the car off the road. I was so offended by a comment like that. And then we wonder why the horrendous things that are happening in the world are happening. We have people out there spouting filth and venom like this. It's absolutely disgrace. And again, the thing that bothers me personally as much as anything is that it doesn't take long when you listen to this before the Obama. Whatever happened to the original idea of the founders? Whatever happened to the value system and the morality? And the public-spirited virtue that was associated with the founders? What? I've been doing a lot of teaching for the last half century plus. I can't ever remember ever saying in my whole life that what I was saying, which was clearly my opinion, was truth. That's incredible, if you think about it. But anyway, that's the issue that I wanted to open up with today, because very honestly, it's so directly related to the Constitution. It's so clearly in the wheelhouse of the virtual center. It is potentially so important. And I think one other thing that it does, which I think is very significant, is it gives us a sense. It allows us to see the potential and the implications of the kinds of things that are going on. The issue that I really wanted to address in today's program, and I honestly thought that particular issue would probably only take 15-20 minutes. I thought we'd have the better part of our 2-hour program left for another issue. I keep going back to the ideas I tell people. You know, people tell, you know, I'm teaching a class, an American history class, that meets 3 times a week for 50 minutes. And the first thing that came into my mind when I took the assignment was, it takes me 50 minutes to say hello. So, and I think you're getting an idea as to where that comes from. But again, I really feel this material, this information, and these perspectives so deeply that once I get into them, I feel like I need to follow through on them. And again, I'm so grateful, so thankful for the Horn, for the Head On Radio Network, and an opportunity to put programs like this on the air. Because once we lose them, if we ever lose them, we're going to be in trouble. Because we've got to know, these people are on all the time. They are screaming, they are bankrolled, they are well-funded by billionaires. And while it seemed absurd and unbelievable at first, even Hitler realized that if the lie is big enough and you say it often enough and say it loud enough, it becomes, in the mind of many, the truth. And I think we're seeing that play out. And we've got to contest it, and we've got to basically offer people an alternative. We've got to begin to call a spade or a spade and encourage people to understand the significance and the full meaning of what it is they're hearing and what's happening. Because it's very, very significant and very, very important. And the opportunity to do that on a daily basis here at the Virtual Center is an opportunity that I cherish every single time that I'm with you, and I will cherish forever, is an opportunity to do this. I wanted to go back, and we've got about 10 minutes left in this, our first hour, so let me kind of set the stage here, and then we can pursue this later on. During our conversations in previous weeks and months, one of the issues that we focused on in a number of different contexts is the nature of the two-party system in America. I can remember a specific program in which we addressed the issue of responsible and non-responsible political parties in our two-party system. And we talked about the strengths and the weaknesses of such a party. It's principally philosophical, it's political. You know, it's political science. It's the essence of American government classes. And on the surface, it's incredibly dull, because it deals with processes, and it deals with system, and it deals with a number of things that students, typical students, find rather dumb and not really relevant. The fact of the matter is, this issue is particularly relevant, not only at the time that the two-party system was developing in America, but today. And I think we're seeing it as it's played out in our political contest. The one we were just talking about abolishing the 17th Amendment, is an example of that. And I wanted to revisit the particular subject of America's two-party system for a specific reason. I mentioned at the very opening of today's program that today, the 19th of November, is the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And this past weekend, Sunday, repeated yesterday in the Washington Post as a feature op-ed piece, was a brilliant piece of writing by one of the nation's most accomplished Civil War historians, Drew Gilpin Faust. Drew Gilpin Faust is president of Harvard University. She is also an accomplished historian, Civil War historian, and has written a fabulous book on suffering during the Civil War, on the pain and suffering and death associated with the Civil War. It's a brilliant job. And so Drew Gilpin Faust is invited on a number of speaking engagements, and it's really interesting because, for the most part, I would guess, she is out there representing Harvard University and representing higher education in her presentations. But occasionally, she's asked to speak as a historian. And on this 50th anniversary of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, she wrote this op-ed piece for the Washington Post, which I thought was brilliant. I printed copies and distributed them to my students because right now in the American history course that I'm teaching 3 days a week, we're moving into the last 2.5 to 3 weeks of the semester before the final exam in early December. And we're looking at the events and the issues and the considerations, perspectives that led up to the South seceding from the Union in 1860 and 1861 as a result of Abraham Lincoln's election in the election of 1860. And over the next 4 or 5 classes, we're going to be looking in some detail at the Dred Scott decision, at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, at the outbreak of the war. We're going to look at the strengths, the apparent military strategy for both sides, the strengths and weaknesses of both sides. And ultimately, we're going to look at the factors that went into Lincoln's decision to emancipate slaves, effective January 1, 1863. And in a survey class like this particular class is, that's really about all we can, that's about as much depth as we can get into. However, I will mention that these students have an assignment which counts 50% of the equivalent of an exam. What I've done in addition to in-class exams in this course is to give them 2 take-home papers. And what they've been asked to do is do an analytical interpretive essay on these particular primary sources. The first assignment that I gave them several weeks ago was based on Benjamin Rush's Mode of Education Proper in a Republic, which was written in 1786. As you know, we've covered that here at the Virtual Center. The second assignment that I've given them a copy of Jefferson Davis's address in the Confederacy when the Confederacy first came into existence after the states in the Deep South had seceded, and also a copy of Lincoln's inaugural address delivered in 1861. Both of them were delivered within 2 weeks of each other. One in Alabama, the other one in Washington, D.C. And what I've asked students to do is take both of these speeches, both of these inaugural addresses, and do a comparative analysis of the two around the theme of the nature of the union. In other words, how does each man look at the union? What is the basis of his case? And I've asked them to pretend. I've asked each student to pretend to be the Supreme Court ruling on the legitimacy of this particular debate. In other words, if it were debate before your court, who would win? Who seemed to have the strongest case on the nature of the union and why? And that assignment is due Friday. This Friday. So this is right where we are in our course right now. And so Drew Gilpin's Faust article was one that I couldn't resist sharing with the students, because her expertise in the period, it just oozes her knowledge and her expertise and her sensitivities. And she points out, you know, that one of the biggest surprises is the war was ever fought at all. In fact, she makes the point that many people at the time never believed that this would be a war. And then she cites, for example, one of the members of the South Carolina Senate, one of the senators from South Carolina, whose name was Chestnut, was so sure that there wouldn't be a war, that the North would never fight over this, that the North would just let us go if we chose to secede from the Union, that he even promised to drink whatever blood might be shed because he was convinced that there wouldn't be any. Well, the fact of the matter is, even those who felt that there might be a war didn't think it would last long, and she points this out, because most people believed that the Union would never be committed enough to stick it out. Why would people volunteer to give up their lives and come to fight for a cause that they really didn't care about? Most of them were so far away. These people were from Vermont and Maine and Wisconsin and Michigan, and they had never even been to the they had no idea what the Confederacy was about. And most of them would say, hell, if they're stupid enough to leave the Union, let them go. And so many people believed that the Union would never stick it out, and so even if there was a war, it would be short. There's absolutely no question, for example, and she points this out as well, that the South's military strategy was in part based on these assumptions. The whole idea of General Lee's determination to bring his army across the Potomac and strike in the North, in Maryland, and ultimately Gettysburg, western Pennsylvania, is based on the assumption that if we can do enough damage quickly to the North, they'll just throw up their hands and say, this is worth it, let's find a way to settle this. So because they believed that there wouldn't be a war, or if there was, it wouldn't last long, because there wasn't the kind of commitment to a military struggle that would be necessary to support a long war, Lee and the Confederate generals believed that if we can strike hard and fast, we can win this thing. And of course, the bulk of her article is that it's a credit to Abraham Lincoln more than anybody else that he was able to make defense of the Union meaningful enough to people that 10% of the population of the North at the time, the population of the North at the time, produced a military force that was incredible and ultimately won the war. So the question she raises in the article is there any possibility in God's world that 10% of America's population today would come forward and give up their jobs and their homes and careers and everything else and come forward to defend the nation. And her feeling is, if we were ever going to have that, we need somebody, we need another Lincoln, and there aren't that many of them around. And so, basically, her whole approach in the article is to talk about the effectiveness of Lincoln as orator and symbol, and his ability to take an attack on the Union and turn it into something that was really meaningful to citizens, to the point that they would see an attack on the Union as an attack on them and their best interests and their future and everything that they held dear. And Lincoln was able to do that as few people could. It's a beautiful, beautiful article. Beautiful article. And I'm sure it's still available in the Washington Post. If you just type in on your computer, on your Explorer, your browser, WashingtonPost.com, and then look at the op-ed, the opinion pages, and it's only 24 hours ago. It was in the yesterday morning, so it would still be available for you to read. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece. Let's pause and take our break. We've just passed the top of the hour. It's 2 minutes after the hour, the top of the hour. We'll pause and take a five-minute break, and we'll come back, and we'll try to make sense out of this. Where is all this going, this talk about the Civil War in this day and age and the two parties? What's going on here? Hopefully, we can make sense of this and bring this to a logical conclusion in our next hour. Please stay tuned. And we'll give it a try. I'm Bill O'Brien. You're listening to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. I invite you to stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
We now return to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility with your host, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid, and welcome back to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility on this Tuesday, the 19th of November in the year 2013. I'm Bill O'Brien, and it is a pleasure to welcome you back. And thank you for, if you've been with us, for staying with us. And if you are just joining in to our program today, welcome. And we are looking at the at an issue which I think is very significant. And in our prior hour, we kind of looked forward to this particular issue. We were kind of setting it up, the idea of looking at the nature of our two-party system, which we've looked at before. And I think it's very, very significant, and I wanted to spend some time today getting into it, because I think it is extremely, extremely important. Let me begin, first of all, by encouraging you to participate actively in the program by giving us a call, feeling free to share your ideas and your thoughts with our audience here at the Virtual Center. The phone number is area code 304-658-3333. 304-658-3333. If you'd like to email me your ideas individually, personally, then by all means I would welcome I look forward to hearing from you. My email address is waobrien906@gmail.com. waobrien906@gmail.com. O'Brien is I-E-N, not I-A-N, which a number of folks often do. It is I-E-N. Basically, what we've been doing here is setting up this particular issue, because I think it's particularly important, and it stems from the course that I'm teaching, which is the Origins of the Civil War. And I was talking just before the break about Drew Gilpin Faust's article. Drew Gilpin Faust is president of Harvard University, but she's also one of the nation's most accomplished Civil War historians. And she has written an absolutely fabulous book on death and suffering in the Civil War on the part of both sides, and the impact that it had on regions and families and sections and states. And just a beautiful, beautiful, beautifully done book. In the course of bringing my course, the class I'm teaching, to an end, I gave students a couple of pages of interpretive questions about what they're reading. My whole approach, I'm not going to go into this in any detail at this point, but my whole approach in teaching a course is to lay out the kind of interpretive way of looking at the information that students are reading about, which suggests a way to tie it all together. Could you look at it this way? What if you looked at it that way? Is it possible to argue for this? Could one argue for that? And what I'm trying to basically do is get students to look at information in a number of different ways. And so beginning to appreciate how conservatives would tend to look at a particular issue, how liberals would pretend to look at a particular issue, what each side would emphasize, and how that emphasis in itself kind of dictates the agenda or the priorities of the person that we're talking about. As many of you know, with the attention that we've given to the founders and to the framers of the Constitution, obviously I'm very, very much a fan of the founders. I think they've left us with a miraculous gift, as Benjamin Franklin said, if only we can keep it, which is a republic. But one of the elements of that gift, which is really not in the Constitution but emerges very quickly afterwards, is the emergence of two-party politics in America. It happens very, very early in the nation's history in the administration of George Washington. And the two parties tend to split and divide around the personages of Alexander Hamilton, the Federalist, and Thomas Jefferson, the Republican. And, of course, it's understandable, and it stands to reason at the time, that Hamilton and most of the leading Federalists didn't believe that they were really reflecting a representative of a political party at all. They were the group that was having the most influence on government policy as it was coming out of the Washington administration. So their position is, this is the rule. We have a popular government. We have a republic. People can vote. This is basically what we've decided. And people's option is either to support it or leave. You know, you're either a good citizen of America or you're not. You either support your government or you don't. And what was missing is this whole idea of the principle of what we call a loyal opposition. The idea that serious, legitimate, patriotic people could disagree on policy and procedure, and that good people could disagree with other good people. And very quickly, this recognition of the value of the idea of a loyal opposition becomes reflected in the emerging two-party system that develops during the 1790s. And, of course, one of the greatest ironies of all this is that one of the major architects of this is James Madison himself, the author of Federalist 10, the author of the Virginia Plan. And historians for numbers of years have been playing around with, how do you explain Madison here? Is he just two-faced? Is he just a politician? Did he have a change of heart? What exactly is going on? How could Madison argues so strongly in favor of the need for a strong central government in the Federalist Papers and in the Constitution, and then turn around less than a decade later and start to advocate states' rights to the point that he actually authors the Virginia Resolutions in response to the very unpopular Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798. And he even introduces the idea of the right of states to interpose and nullify legislation and to protect the people of their states from offensive, dangerous federal legislation. I mean, this seems wholly a 180-degree reversal with Madison. And the way I choose to look at this, and I've always told myself I'd love to be able to find time to do the research and actually write this up, but I think it would take the kind of intensive research that I haven't had the time to do. But I believe that Madison, probably more than anybody else, was so knowledgeable and so insightful about the nature of political behavior during this period. All you have to do is read the details of some of these Federalist Papers. When he talks about voters and man and what man wants and how man behaves and man's self-interest versus public interest and all these other things, and you begin to realize that this guy is really on top of what it's all about. It is my belief, in order to make a long story short, it is my belief that Madison quickly recognized in the 1790s that the new federal system created by the Constitution had one major flaw or gap in it. And that one major flaw is that there was no room in it for the idea of a loyal opposition. And so consequently, people who disagreed with federal policy were almost forced to become enemies to their own nation in order to oppose it. And it was very clear that the hostility and emotion that was being generated by the Federalists and by the Federalist program, specifically Hamilton's financial program, the opposition and the emotion surrounding it was such that it looked like the nation could literally split over these policies and programs. And the only way to hold the nation together, the only way to really ensure that the Republican government created by the Constitution could continue to exist, that popular government in America could really work, is to find a way not to drive people out of the system, but drive them into it. To find a way for the system itself to entertain disagreement and objection and different points of view. And the benefit of that would be that if you turn attention into the political system itself, into the election process, then what you do, what you can do is promise people that a strength of our system, unlike other systems around the world, is that our system is potentially friendly to change. It's possible, even if you disagree, to secure power and have your point of view enacted if you can get enough people in enough states to agree with you. In other words, if you can organize the opposition. And so the nature of the two-party system is to create these two national parties that are competing with each other for power through the election box, through the election process. And the idea, because it's a majority rule situation, majority rule government requires that the only way to build majorities is to be willing to compromise, to negotiate. In order to create a majority and have a chance at the national level, parties are required to moderate their positions. Extremists can't win in this kind of a system, because since they are so extreme, it doesn't matter whether they're extreme left or extreme right. The mere fact that they are extremists means that they will lose everybody on the other side of the midpoint, but they will also lose many of their own people who support them, but not to the extreme and the degree that they advocate. It's very obvious, for example, using today's situation as an example, that there's no way in the world that a majority of the American people are going to become supporters of the Tea Party. It's too extreme. Its positions are too definitive. It doesn't shy away from taking positions. On the contrary, it seems to want to take positions on everything. And the result is, everybody who takes the position as a Tea Party supporter alienates two people who aren't. And so what the Tea Party becomes then is not a competitor for national power through majority rule, but rather a force for change within the major parties. In other words, if the Republican Party on the national level is going to win back power by getting control of the Senate and the presidency, the White House, then the thinking of our two-party system is they're going to have to moderate their views in order to appeal to conservative people who may not be quite as conservative as they are. And so therefore, it benefits Democrats to try to, it benefits Democrats to try to pin the Republican label on the Tea Party, or the Tea Party label on Republicans. The more Democrats are successfully able to paint Republicans as extremists, the more likely it is that Democrats will retain control of the national government. And the same thing works on the other side. What the two-party system does by pushing compromise and negotiation is drive both parties towards the center, towards moderation on political issues. Consequently, our two-party system, rather than dividing the nation irreparably, tends to bring it together by building negotiation and compromise. It feeds on it. However, there's a problem. And the problem is that if you look at this system in operation, then it tends to jettison extremists. And what I mean is, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about people on the extreme left or on the extreme right. It doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is, because the two-party system feeds on compromise, on negotiation, on moderation, extremists begin to recognize very quickly that they can't win. Third parties can't win in this system because they're too definitive. What they stand for is so clear that there are too many people opposed to them. So increasingly what we find is that extremists at both end of the political spectrum oftentimes tend to become non-participants. They tend to drop out of the system because they don't see any way that they can be successful within it. The very nature of the system works against them because they're not willing to compromise their principles. So in a sense, to try to bring this to a conclusion, because this is just introduction, to try to bring this introductory concepts, these concepts to a conclusion here at this point, is to suggest that our two-party system has both strengths and weaknesses. And the irony is they're both exactly the same. And what I mean is the strengths of this system is its tendency to compromise, to promote moderation and compromise and negotiation. But many people see the weakness of the system, the fact that it does exactly that. It tends to suggest that even though the people are presented with a choice between A and B, between Democrats and Republicans, between the left and the right, between conservatives and liberals, however you want to define it, the fact of the matter is when push comes to shove and somebody wins, the result usually brings us back to the middle again. The first priority of everybody that wins a national election is to put the hostility of the campaign behind them and find a way to reach out across the aisle and get people to work together. And that happens in the very first election that the nation experiences under this system, which is the election of Thomas Jefferson in 1800. And Jefferson himself called his election a revolution. And the reason he termed it a revolution is because this was the first time in the history of the world that there had been a peaceful transfer of government power from one group to another without a war. That what we had proven in this country in the 1790s, that people could debate and campaign and argue and scream and holler and put up broadsides and write newspaper articles and seek votes by claiming that if the other side wins, it's going to be the end of life as we know it and the world as we know it and all of that. But when the day comes and the election is over and the people have spoken, then the winning party begins to say, all right, now it's time for all of us to get back together again and let's work together and let's fix some of these issues. that we've been fighting over for the last several months during the campaign. And so one of the things you'll see in Jefferson's inaugural, which is available on the internet, just look at Jefferson's inaugural address in the election of 1800. And what you'll see, the most famous line in that inaugural address is Jefferson's opening claim, "We are all Republicans, we are all Democrats." And that's the compromise that becomes the tip-off for what two-party systems elections have become in this country since that very first one. The problem is, well, first of all, let's give credit where credit is due. When Madison talked about, in Federalist Number 10, about finding a way to preserve the spirit and the form of popular government, yet at the same time addressing the issue of the violence of factions, this was part of the formula for success. The emergence of the two-party system becomes part of that. Rather than politics dividing the nation and creating divisiveness and hostility, our political system brings people together because it rewards compromise, it rewards people's abilities to put aside the differences, the things that divide them, and looks for the things that unite them. In other words, let's not look for the things we don't agree on. Let's look at the things we do agree on, and let's see if we can kind of build on what we agree on, and then we'll worry about the things we disagree on later on. And that kind of spirit seems to drive America's two-party politics throughout its history. And so the result is, if you think back to it, when a party wins, the people who supported it, the people who worked hard for its victory, say, our guys are in power, now we're going to get everything we want. And the fact of the matter is they never do, because if one side gets everything it wants, then the other side gets everything it doesn't want. And if the system did that, then people would cease to be good citizens. They would cease to support it. So the only way to make sure each group is willing to continue to support the system is to give people hope. Hey, we didn't win this time, but maybe if we organize better and work a little bit harder, we can win next time. And in the meantime, what we've got to do is find a way to get as much as we can out of the fact that the other side won. But the reality is, because the other side had to moderate its positions in order to win, in order to secure a majority vote, the other side isn't doing anything too extreme anyway. So chances are you'll be able to live with the other side being in power for a while, at least if you believe that you might win control the next time around. And so that tends to perpetuate our system from election to election, and it keeps people in the game. It keeps people within the system. It's not a system that drives people out. It's a system that invites people in. This is our political institution. It's brilliant. I think you have to be pretty naive, and you have to really have a very, very unfair attitude, position towards James Madison, to believe that Madison was an architect of this whole thing at the very beginning of our nation's history and didn't realize what he was doing. I think this may have been one of Madison's greatest accomplishments, was his ability to conceptualize and to see how potentially divisive politics could be unless we found a way to make it work for us instead of allowing it to work against us. We were a new nation of immigrants. We were a nation that had to build consensus and community. We had to have a political system that would do that, not a political system that would jeopardize that. And these guys did it. And it's brilliant. Here's the point. In order for this to work, then by definition, the priorities always have to be issues on which compromise is possible. a system that requires negotiation and compromise in order to work is a system that becomes very uncomfortable when it is forced to deal with issues where compromise is not possible. It can't work. If you go back to the pre-Constitution days, 1780s in Virginia politics, 1786 to be specific, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison together designed the Virginia Law for Religious Freedom in Virginia, what becomes the origin of separation of church and state in America. They do it for Virginia. If you go online and you read Madison's tract, Madison's abstract on the Virginia Bill for Religious Freedom, you will read Madison's thinking. And if you look at Jefferson, you'll see his thinking on the same thing. And what these two guys realize is that Virginia politics, and we're not talking at the national level as yet, that Virginia politics is potentially at a crisis point. Because the state of Virginia has enacted legislation which taxes the citizens of Virginia to support the Anglican Church, later to become the Episcopal Church. The Anglican Church, or the Episcopal Church, becomes the state religion in Virginia, and everybody is taxed to support it. But the reality of life in 18th century Virginia is that while many people were Anglicans and went to church on a regular basis, as long as population was focused principally in the eastern parts of Virginia, in and around Norfolk and Williamsburg, and even as far west as Richmond, the fact of the matter is, when population continues to increase and the flow of it begins to move further and further west in Virginia into the Shenandoah Valley, and people begin to move up the valley into western Pennsylvania or down the valley into the Carolinas, or citizens are coming in, immigrants are coming into Philadelphia and moving west in Pennsylvania and then down the valley, down what is now Interstate 81, which is one of the most heavily traveled roads in the nation. What you begin to see in Virginia in the 18th century is an influx of new denominations in Protestantism, most specifically Baptists and Methodists. And what makes Baptists and Methodists so appealing is that these are denominations that appeal to the reality of the life that the people in Western Virginia are living. The problem with the Anglican Church, is that the church is the focus of the religion. It's necessary for the people to come to the church. And that's fine as long as the people live in the immediate neighborhood. But when population starts to spread out through the mountains and down the valleys, it's impossible for people to come to church. It's necessary for the church to go to them. And both the Methodist Church and the Baptist Church adopt the idea of circuit riders, of pastors and ministers, preachers, who get on horseback and ride out to where the people are and set up tent revivals and a number of other things. In other words, religion conforms to the nature of where the people are, where the converts are. And so what we're seeing is religion being brought to the people rather than requiring the people to come to it. The result is, by the time you get into the 1780s in Virginia, you got a problem. Because you have large numbers of citizens who are not Anglicans. Yet their legislature is taxing them to support a church they don't subscribe to. Not only that, but it doesn't take any political notice at all of the churches that they do belong, that they do subscribe to. Religion becomes a very potentially divisive issue in Virginia. And Jefferson and Madison speak to that in their religious, in their bill for religious freedom in Virginia in 1786. Which effectively says, that it is not right to tax people to support a church that they don't, that they are not comfortable with. And that what we have to do is we have to recognize that different people worship God in different ways, and that they, and that what we need to do is respect their right and their freedom to do that. And to try to impose a specific religion on people who have bought into alternative religions is potentially extremely destructive of society. It potentially will destroy community. So Madison makes very clear, and so does Jefferson, that the answer is a dual strategy. The first piece is we have got to basically take a position that people are free to worship God however they want. Madison even introduces the idea that if we're going to put the premium on freedom, then we have to recognize that people are free to not worship God at all if they choose to do that. And the result is a total separation of church and state in the state of Virginia. What Madison and Jefferson are doing is giving us insight into what you need to do in order to govern a diverse community. What you have to do is, in order to govern people, you have to govern them on the principles on which everybody can agree. But you've got to take the issues around which, on which people disagree off the table. In Virginia, in the middle of the 1780s, religion is potentially very divisive. It's very explosive. Consequently, government has got to take it off the table. Government cannot afford to push one particular religion at the expense of others. It's just going to create animosity and hostility and division in society. It's going to disrupt community. It's going to make government impossible. And that's the origin of religious freedom in America. And it's generally accepted. People recognize the validity of this. So religious freedom becomes one of the major amendments that the state constitutions adopt after independence in 1776 and 1777. And of course, religion freedom becomes the key to the First Amendment to the Bill of Rights when the Bill of Rights is introduced in 1790 by the new Congress under the Constitution. What I want to take our time with today, we have 20 minutes left in our program, what I want to do is focus more on the principle than on the issue. I don't want to get into, I don't want to get off on, onto the issue of religious freedom at this point. I want to rather go back to the idea of emotional issues versus non-emotional issues. I want to focus on issues around which people can come together, as opposed to those issues on which people can never come together because they can't compromise. There's no way in God's world that people are going to compromise on what they believe about life and death, what they believe about God. what they do have to hold them together, what they do all agree on, is the principle of freedom. Maybe we ought to basically put the premium on freedom and say people are free to worship God however they want, not worship God at all, whatever they choose to do. That's their right. That's not a political issue. We, as political leaders, have no business even touching that issue. Because once we do, we're going to create problems. We're not going to resolve them. There's a lesson there. There's a lesson there. And it's that lesson that I want to focus on. And that is that the very nature of our political system suggests that it can only work when the issues on the table are compromisable, unnegotiable. When the issues are such that people can come together and reach some sort of meeting of the ways around that particular issue. But when an issue becomes so emotional and so personal and potentially so inflammable that people will never compromise on it, will never negotiate on it because they can't, then that issue has to be off the political table. It can't be on. The example of this, I would suggest, is the way the government of the United States addresses the issue of slavery from the nation's founding all the way up to the Civil War. And I'm just going to touch on a number of issues here, many of them you'll be familiar with. But again, I'm touching on content, but mostly what I'm doing is making a point. If you go back to the negotiations surrounding Jefferson's draft of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, you will find, we addressed this at the time, that Jefferson is forced to make 86 changes in his first draft. And one of the major ones is to get rid of everything in the Declaration of Independence that talks about or addresses the issue of slavery. Because the reality is the Southern states threatened to walk out of the Continental Congress and not support the Declaration of Independence unless Jefferson is willing to remove all the language which is anti-slavery or anti-slave trade or which suggests anything about doing anything about slavery. So by definition, in order to get the states to work together and support independence together, they were forced to take the slavery issue off the table because it was too divisive. I would suggest to you that all the signs leading to the Civil War begin there. If you go to the Constitutional Convention in 1787, the Southern delegates continually threatened to walk out unless some agreement, some compromise is reached over the issue of slavery. And the result, one of the results, is the very famous Three-Fifths Compromise. The Northern states want to consider slaves as property and tax them, which will be more money coming into the federal government. The Southern states want slaves counted as people, so they'll have more representatives in Congress than will the North, because there are millions of slaves. The compromise position, this, what the textbooks refer to as the Great Compromise, now obviously nobody stood up in the Congress and said, I want to propose a great compromise. But the fact of the matter is, the compromise they reach is three-fifths on both representation and taxation. Three-fifths of the slave will count for both. And that's what they are forced to do in order to hold the convention, hold the Constitutional Convention together. And then the other issue is the slave trade. And the decision in the Constitution is that nothing will happen to the slave trade for at least 20 years. The whole world, Great Britain is leading the charge as nations in Europe are beginning to turn against and ban and abolish the slave trade. And there are a lot of people within the in the Continental Congress from the North that want to do the same thing. And the compromise they are forced to reach in order to keep the South in the room is that we will take a position, we'll do something about the slave trade, but we won't do it until 1808. In other words, we'll give you 20 years to figure out something. And of course, the thinking in the South is, by then there'll be so many slaves that they'll be able to repopulate themselves and we won't need to depend on international trade in slaves like we have. And these become included in the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution of the United States is compromising around one of the most emotional issues that the nation faces at that time. The way to deal with it is to find a way to compromise on it. And then we move into the history of the nation and we get Hamilton's program and the separation into two parties over it. And we continue to move in that direction. And finally, we come to 1820 and the very famous Missouri Compromise of 1820. And the state of Missouri applies for admission into the Union as a slave state. Up until this point, there are the same number of slave states as there are free states. And the North is committed to the idea that we're not going to allow slavery to expand any further. And the South is committed to the idea that the slave system must be allowed to expand. And so basically, what ultimately the decision is to recognize Maine's right to break away from Massachusetts and apply for separate statehood as a free state. And so by allowing Maine to come in as a free state and Missouri to come in as a slave state, you are able to maintain the balance between slave states and free states. By this time, the South has become very cognizant of the fact that it's not going to control Congress. It's not going to control the bulk of the inflow of immigrants into the country because the very existence of the slave system tends to drive immigrants elsewhere. And so most of the immigrant population is coming into the middle states and into the northern states and moving into what is then the Northwest Territory, which becomes today the Midwest, Wisconsin and Michigan and Iowa and Ohio and Indiana and those states. And so it's very clear to the South that with most of the population coming into the nation from overseas, going into the northern states, non-slave states, that there's no way in the world that the slave system can perpetuate itself by hoping that at some point in time the South will control Congress. But as long as the South can maintain an equal number of states, they can maintain a veto power in the Senate because every state has two senators. Consequently, the South can veto any anti-Southern legislation that might come through Congress by opposition in the Senate. So the South's position on maintaining an equal number of states becomes critical. Once again, the government has tried to compromise the uncompromisable. Even though most knowledgeable people at the time acknowledge that at some point in time we're going to have to do something about slavery, Jefferson in his Notes on the State of Virginia makes the comment in 1782 when he writes that he refers to slavery as a fire bell in the night. And his argument is we're going to have to do something about this. We can't just keep dodging it and compromising around it. Or the term that we hear today oftentimes, we can't keep kicking the can down the road. At some point in time, we're going to have to deal with this. My point is that the nature of our political system, which is based on negotiation and compromise, can't deal with it. It's too emotional. In other words, I would suggest that the very outbreak of the Civil War itself is proof positive that our government cannot handle the most volatile, sensitive, divisive issues. It can only handle the issues on which compromise is possible. I think all of us need to appreciate that. We need to take that and chew on it and think about it. And then we need to look at the nature of today's politics. And we need to look at those people, whether they be liberals or whether they be conservatives, who insist that government take positions and pass legislation on such things as when life begins, the circumstances under which life can end, the issue of stem cell research, the issue of creating life in a petri dish, the idea of taking fertilized eggs and freezing them and then artificially inseminating them later on in human beings, the issue of raising stem cells with the purchase of addressing and combating serious diseases and maladies in the nation's people. The idea of abortion. The idea of gay marriage. Every one of these is an issue where compromise is impossible. It's kind of like slavery. If you think about it, during the 1830s, we had William Lloyd Garrison and the extreme abolitionists who were basically forcing the nation to confront the realities of slavery and say it is inhuman, it is unchristian, it is wrong, it is immoral, it is a sin, and therefore, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we have to abolish it. And then you have these well-meaning people that the textbooks refer to as gradualists, the people who say, yeah, admittedly, slavery's not right. It violates every principle that this nation is built upon. At some point in time, we're going to have to find a way to do something about slavery. But what do you do with 4 million people who were brought here against their will? How do you control them? How do you prevent race war? How do you abolish slavery and avoid what everybody assumes will be race war in this country? Lincoln becomes a supporter of the American Colonization Society. Free the slaves and send them all back to Africa, and thus the creation of the nation of Liberia. But the reality is that's not considered feasible for a lot of reasons, but especially many of the slaves themselves say, hey, we were born here. This is our country as well as it is yours. Why should we be required to move? You leave. And so what we begin to see is violence prior to the Civil War against William Lloyd Garrison and the extreme abolitionists, because they are raising issues and forcing people to confront realities that they don't want to confront and make decisions they don't want to make. And so there's all sorts of examples of violence and threatened violence against the abolitionists, because they will not stop raising a question that people don't have an answer to. You can't compromise it. They're saying there is no compromise. If it's wrong, get rid of it. Worry about the consequences later. There's no difference in terms of the emotional, divisive nature of slavery from abortion or gay marriage or life in the petri dish or any of these other things that we see. And yet, just as we had politicians in the 1840s and especially the 1850s who were running for political office on the slavery issue, if I'm elected, I will never allow slavery to expand one more inch. And Southern politicians saying, elect me and we'll make sure that the war on slavery will stop. And if we have to, we'll leave the Union in order to protect our sacred institution. An institution that is in the Bible and is supported in the Bible in Scripture. And so what we see is politicians running for office trying to get elected by taking uncompromisable positions in a political system which must have compromised to survive. Think about that. We have politicians who are taking positions which promise not to compromise in a system which has to have compromise. The message is that the issues on which American politics was functioning in the 1840s and 50s, slavery, was so emotional and so human, there was no way in the world that the system built on compromise could address it. All they could do is kick the can down the road and find a way to leave it to the next generation to solve. They'll find a way later on. Let's get rid of it now. And finally, the nation went to war over. And here we are in the 21st century conducting our politics on the same kinds of non-negotiable, uncompromisable issues where each side is attacking moderates as unprincipled people who stand for nothing, who will go whichever way the wind blows, etc., etc., etc. In a sense, we are conducting our political system on issues that our political system cannot survive unless we can find a way to get those off the table. That's what Madison told us, that's what Jefferson told us, and that's what we better do. Because if we don't, and this move, state by state by state, to call another constitutional convention and enact one of these extreme agendas, which is the Liberty Amendments of Mark Levin, will be a reality all of us will have to face, and then what happens? We are at 59 minutes after the hour. Our day is done. I want to thank you for giving the Virtual Center some of your valuable time. I hope you'll come back and visit us again tomorrow. Please stay tuned for the Head On Radio Network for Bob Kincaid. I know he's pacing back and forth waiting to take over. It is now 6 p.m. in the East. Have a good evening. Be safe.
Cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! About 2 minutes past the hour, this is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, my first day back after a little bit of time on the road.
We'll talk about that in a little bit later. I had an amazing trip up to the shores of Lake Superior and the good people of Ashland and Iron Counties, and of course my dear friends out on the Bad River Reservation, struggling against rogue hillbilly and serial poisoner Chris Klein as he attempts to destroy that beautiful part of the country with his relentless greed and remorseless determination to see a beautiful community, you know, turned into a poisoned and dying place. We'll talk about all of that later, but I want to jump right into the heart of things this evening, because I have a dear friend who is on hold right now. My first conversation with Jeff Biggers took place almost as long ago now as the horn is old. And we have had many conversations in the interim. Jeff Biggers, of course, is a tireless advocate and journalist, writing about struggles in communities threatened by extractive industries, by coal, by fracking. And he has an article out, a brand new article just today over at Huffington Post, Fracking Illinois, Two or Three Things We Know for Sure. And the minute I read it, I knew that we were going to be talking about this story, but I wanted to reach out to Jeff because he is going to be far better at talking about this issue than am I by myself. So without further ado, let's bring Jeff Biggers on. Hey, Jeff, do I still have you?
Yeah, going down the road. Good to talk to you, Bob.
Oh, it's always good to talk to you, Jeff. You've been doing magnificent work, and I guess it's work sort of close to home, because this particular article deals with fracking in Illinois, and I was wondering if maybe you could just give us a little bit of background on how we got to the point where you wound up writing this article.
Well, you know, as I think a lot of your listeners know, Illinois is really one of the oldest coal markets we have in the country. In fact, the first coal market, dating all the way back to the French who discovered coal in the 17th century. But to make a long story short, we've been fighting and dealing with the coal industry for years, and then suddenly, with hydraulic fracking, horizontal, is that they realized, oh my God, there's this incredible amount of oil and natural gas. And so not only did we have a revival of the coal rush that we've been dealing with for the past couple years, but now suddenly all the frackers were coming to the state. What made it extremely interesting, I think, to your listeners, Bob, is that Illinois is a very liberal, democratic state. Liberal Governor Quinn, Democrats control the legislature. And yet, even in a state like that, they had to sort of bow to the whims of the great coal and natural gas lobby. And they ran through a bill last year that really brought a lot of attention to the state, not simply for fracking, but how the environmental groups handled it. There was a very unfortunate split between the main big greens, as we refer to them, the main national organizations that are based in Chicago, primarily in Springfield, who wanted to once again make a compromise, versus the grassroots, the local citizens groups and environmentalists on the front lines who said, hey, we can't do these compromises. We've dealt with over a century of coal mining mayhem. We don't want to have another century of mayhem with natural gas. And that's pretty much when I came into the story, was to chronicle and serve as a reporter for the voices that are fighting back.
And you have always been a voice for people left largely voiceless. You're absolutely right, Jeff. You chronicle some of the predatory practices in Appalachia in the United States, of your book, award-winning book, The United States of Appalachia. And then you took it all the way right to home in Reckoning with Eagle Creek. And I'm guessing that did it come as a surprise to people who consider themselves either liberal or Democrat or progressive, or that they could be so rapidly sold out in the fracking fight?
You know, I think it was a real wake up call for a lot of young environmental activists and people who don't have the sort of background that we already have in coal mining. I think my role as a cultural historian was to remind people that, hey, you know, in the 1970s, we had a very vibrant and incredible, very inspiring movement to abolish strip mining. And that ultimately, when a liberal Democrat got into the White House, we had another compromise for various reasons. And a young congressman by the name of Nikki Jo Rahal was able to sort of pull the wool over old Mo Udall's eyes in Congress, and we created the Surface Mine Reclamation Act, which ultimately, as you know very well, federally sanctioned mountaintop removal. And that sort of compromise, led by, instigated, and ultimately manipulated by backroom deals with the big environmental lobbyists, always have undercut the interests of people who are paying the price. That's the people who live in the extraction areas. And so it was that sort of history that I had to bring back in Illinois, because we went through the same disaster at SMACRA. Of course, my family's 200-year-old farm was strip mined under SMACRA. And I think we tried to bring history into the debate of fracking, saying, hey, let's stop it before it starts, and please learn our history before you once again compromise so quickly, because we know what's going to happen. And today, frankly, was an article I wrote that the point of it was to say, look, we told you so.
And there's a lot of I told you so in it, just as there's a lot of we told you so in SMACRA. Of course, SMACRA predates any involvement I had. But you're absolutely right. One, you had people out there ostensibly acting on behalf of the environment, and the people living on the ground got hung out to dry, whether it be SMACRA and surface mining, or whether it be what happened to you in the last year in Illinois. What exactly was the process whereby the Illinois fracking sellout took place?
Well, for a little while, in the 2 years ago, there was a discussion to have a moratorium. And the idea was along the lines of what you're trying to do with the AIC Act, which is to me one of the biggest no-brainers that we can imagine, is before you rush into this extraction mayhem, which will have extraordinary human and health and environmental costs, at least do your homework and know the science and know the health studies behind it and know ultimately what the cost is going to be. And I think that's why the AIC Act, for example, mountaintop removal, should be pushed through immediately and passed. It does something that should have happened 40 years ago. Well, in Illinois, that was the whole push behind the moratorium, was to say, before you rush into this fracking, we don't know really what's going on in other states. We don't really have the scientific information of what's going on in Pennsylvania, where people's water is contaminated, where their water is taking fire, where we have horrific air pollution, where we're seeing earthquakes for the first time in areas that have never had an earthquake in their history. We said, let's just do the studies first. That moratorium never got any grip at all in the legislature. There was too much money behind the lobbies, and they pretty much gave it lip service by the Democrats, but they pushed it aside. They came up with this compromise bill. And I think this, Bob, is really where the cautionary tale has to be told again and again and again. Instead of just putting the brakes on and saying, wait a minute, if you push through this regulatory bill, it's going to have forever implications, long-lasting implications, please, please just stop what you're doing. And the big greens didn't. They worked a deal, a backroom deal. Only a handful of groups were represented in a series of negotiations between the gas and oil industry, the labor representatives, and the governor's office. And four people from four different environmental organizations, none of whom live or represent anybody near the impacted areas, cut this backroom deal that ultimately led to the fiasco, which I wrote about today, is that the fracking rules are a mess.
And that seems to be a common thread in that, excuse me, these big green organizations, and you name them in your article, there's no harm in us mentioning it here, the Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and this organization, Faith in Place, heartbreaking element of this is that they constantly profess to be working on behalf of the people who have to live with this stuff, and yet time after time, you mentioned the AIC Act, and of course what you're talking about in Southern Illinois,
they work in direct contravention of the people who have to live with this. You know what a struggle, well, it hasn't been a struggle. The Sierra Club just has no interest in the AIC Act whatsoever. What is it, Jeff, about this top, is it a top-down mentality? Is it a, we know better than the, where do they get the nerve?
You know, it's a good question, and I think we ask it even without any sense of, anger. I think it's almost being mystified.
Well, mystified and hurt, Jeff.
Yeah. I agree, and for example, Bob, the very same people who cut the deal on the fracking bill have now been appointed to a citizens' task force on fracking by the governor. There's four so-called environmentalists on the task force, and all four people who represent four big green groups don't even live in the region. And so once again, it's like the analogy I use in the article is if you were having a task force on Lake Michigan, for example, would people in Chicago be okay with it is if nobody in Chicago was on it and they only included people from Southern Illinois? Well, obviously not. That's absurd.
Or San Francisco and New York.
Right. And therefore, when you're determining the fate, the future, and the health of the children of people in Southern Illinois, and you don't even have a single person from Southern Illinois, not to mention not a single scientist or healthcare expert, but just paid lobbyists, it's absurd. And I think that's what we're asking. So why, how does it happen? I don't know. I mean, I think we both feel deep in our hearts that the people who work for these organizations believe they're doing good. They're good people. They're not the enemy. I feel like they truly believe in protecting the environment. They truly believe in clean energy alternatives. I just think they don't have the history. They don't have the empirical evidence and experience of living around extraction issues. They don't have the grandfather who coughed up his lungs from black lung, and they still know that three coal miners die daily from black lung disease, even though it's been regulated since 1969. They don't have that kind of sense of urgency. And so when push comes to shove, they get into the cozy circles of lobbyists in Washington or in Springfield or Charleston, West Virginia. And it suddenly becomes a little club, a little game. And the game is, how far can you get these bills? How much can we win? And we have to compromise. That's all part of the game. And at the end of the day, they sort of cut their losses and they walk away and they write their press releases and they can go home. And I think that to me, Bob, is the real problem here is that they just frankly don't realize that at the end of the day, where are you going home? In West Virginia, where are people from Illinois going home? Where are the people from Wisconsin who are being fracked sand mine now? And I think that's the problem: is that we don't have representation of these big environmental groups in the very areas that they need them, and it's just pretty sad.
I keep trying to look at it with all the tools in the toolkit that I've been given over the years. I've tried to analyze it particularly from a privileged position. Because Jeff, I don't like thinking that everything boils down to who has more cash, but the fact of the matter is, you and I have a dear friend, now gone, named Larry Gibson, who literally died weed-eating a mountain, what was left of his mountain in West Virginia, and had been made a hero by these big greens, and had had possibly millions of dollars fundraised on his back, and the guy dies with a weed eater in his hand, for all intents and purposes. It seems like there's some ugly manifestations of privilege there. That as long as people who are working in the grassroots on the ground level are willing to toe the line and do what the self-appointed smart people tell them to do, well, that's great. But the minute, and the AIC Act is an example of this, you know, we waited for years, Jeff, for somebody to come up with a bill in the Congress that would end mountaintop removal. And then after all that waiting, we took this emerging health data and marched off to Washington, D.C. and got it done ourselves. And still to this day, we're waiting for the people who claim to be our voices or for the people who claim to speak for the environment nationally in a couple of different organizations to step up and support what they say that they've been wanting all along, and you get nothing. I mean, it's crickets. And when I first started following the stories that you were publishing a year ago in Illinois, for a while we thought, maybe it's us. Maybe it's just hillbillies. But now I'm finding out, no, it's y'all, and it's people begging in Arizona, and it's people begging in Pennsylvania. And I guess the question, I'm hoping that this article that you've written today at Huffington Post will serve as a kind of a wake-up call. Was that how you intended it?
Well, I mean, I've been ringing the wake-up bell for a long time, Bob, as you know, and I'm not even sure it's being heard anymore. And I think, I think that's the struggle now, is how to raise these issues without getting marginalized in the process. And it's been pretty hard. I mean, I feel like my role is to tell the truth, and it's not to go after any groups in particular. Once again, I consider these our friends.
Yeah, right.
But to tell the truth of what's going on, the damage it's creating, and how we need to rectify it. I try very hard in all my Huffington Post, if I call out a group, is to very much give the evidence, give both sides, but then also give an alternative, that instead of doing this, why aren't you doing that? You know, and for example, the Illinois Environmental Council gave an award, the top award a year, to the main fracker guy, the guy who passed the fracking regulatory bill, who's a total clean coal booster. He's awful, and yet now he's being held up as this kind of rock star for clean energy. It's very, very Orwellian out here in Illinois.
And you know, that kind of thing happens all the time. I remember when the Humane Society of the United States gave its protector of its annual greatest protector of animals award to Nick Joe Rahal a couple of years ago, and I thought, I wonder how the bears and the deer and the fish and all the little critters that run around Central Appalachia feel about that award.
Yeah, and I blogged about that one too, Huffington Post. I'll never forget it. And I got an incredible backlash from wildlife friends in Washington who said, hey, you know, it's part of the deal. He's saving Alaska in the wilderness as part of the deal of mountaintop removal. And I was outraged that they were mad at me for calling them out. But
we together have had people outraged at us before, but, you know, we had one of those about a year and a half ago. But it's stuff that has to be done, and you don't do it out of anger. You do it out of love and respect, frankly. And they don't, for some reason or another, they don't see it that way. You know, you mentioned frac sand mining in western Wisconsin, southeast Minnesota, northern Iowa, a few minutes ago. I got to see that for the first time up close, just driving down from Duluth to Eau Claire the other day. You know, Jeff, there are places where there are these great yellow mounds of sand sitting by railroads by the side of the road, and I thought, oh, my God, paint it black. It looks like home. And then I got to the room where we were speaking, and they had these pictures of mountaintop removal sites, and I thought, well, I'll be damned. Somebody blew up a bunch of mountaintop removal pictures just because they knew we were coming. Well, it wasn't mountaintop removal, Jeff. It was sand mines in western Wisconsin. That people keep begging and saying, please listen to us, and the smart people keep saying, no, 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 we know how to do it right. And I guess that's one of the questions at the end of the day is, why do we have, you know, you and I both know that this is a Pandora's box that once opened is seldom closed and is never closed before something awful has happened. I did notice, or just this evening when I was listening to the radio while I was running an errand, there are people in the Chicagoland area who are upset that some Koch Brothers tar sands coke is being piled up outside their neighborhood. And at one point they thought their neighborhood was on fire because all this dust was just blowing around in the air. And some spokeswoman from Koch Industries said, well, we're hosing it down with water cannons.
All right.
And we haven't seen yet whether this is going to work. Why is it that people living on the ground whether it be Southern Illinois or Wisconsin or Appalachia. Why is it we have to wait for them to make their mistakes first before we start looking for solutions? Because at least in Appalachia, Jeff, as you know probably as well or better than I do, that's 125 years worth of waiting we've been doing.
Right. Yeah, and it's and the key word of solutions too is just it's completely been distorted. The clean energy movement, for example, is one of the few bright spots I think we've had in the past few years. Is creating solar and wind jobs, and they're 99.9% gone to people in non-extraction areas. Illinois ranked 7th in the nation in new clean green jobs. And not a single one of them is south of Springfield. They're all in Chicago or in the north. When the people who absolutely need them to transition from them, just like in West Virginia, need to be the people who are mining coal. And I think that's the other strange issue we're getting right now is that, you know, while we're also paying for the cultural and social backlash, economic backlash of the coal mine and essentially fracking, we also pay the backlash that there's no other economy being developed, no clean energy, no clean energy manufacturing, no wind turbine factories, no solar farms, and precisely in the areas that desperately need it. And that's been my other big battle, is to try to get these people to realize, you know, I don't need you just to shut down the coal fire plant, that's wonderful, but I also need you to help us create some clean energy jobs.
In your article, you reference an activist by the name of Sam Stearns. Can you tell us a little bit about Sam Stearns? His looks like a really compelling story.
So Sam is the Larry Gibson of Illinois. He's almost like the Judy Bonds of Illinois. He's an incredible character. He's fearless, and he's legendary in the Shawnee Woods. He lives deep down in Polk County in the Shawnee National Forest. Been there all his life, third-generation coal miner. He's got family in the coal mines, Hungarian immigrants, I think, originally, probably a century ago. He decided not to work at the coal mines, worked on oil rigs, sort of a rustabout, came back, loved his woods, suddenly realized that they were logging the Shawnee National Forest in a way that was completely illegal. And, you know, the difference between being a nationally protected park and a national forest is that you can do logging, and it's quite a lucrative business. And so he wanted to protect some incredible areas. You know, Southern Illinois has a diversity that matches the Cumberlands or the Ozarks, especially in these few areas that have been saved. And Sam was one of the few people who stood in front of the chainsaws and the bulldozers. This is many, many years ago. Got arrested, led civil disobedience, was betrayed by the Sierra Club, who tried to cut a deal to allow X amount of logging, and he wanted a complete moratorium, and he won. He got to a magical place for us called Bellsmith Springs. It's one of the few incredible areas. We actually have 6 wilderness, federally protected wilderness sites now. It's largely because of people like Sam, who wouldn't take no for an answer and felt like we had to do whatever was necessary to protect these treasures and protect our communities. He's fought tooth and nail with the Sierra Club ever since on just a series of things. You know, the Sierra Club cut a deal and allow the state to spray pesticides in our forest to get rid of invasive species, but at the same time, they could have gone a much more natural route. Sam has fought him on that. He's fought him on the coal mining regulation. And now he finds himself having to fight environmental groups as well as the state for fracking, because fracking is definitely going to be focused on these very fragile areas of Southern Illinois, both with the county national forest and small communities that are not incorporated that, you know, drink water out of their wells. And so Sam has really emerged as this incredibly authentic voice out of the Shawnee, who is speaking, I think, to the needs of the people, someone who knows the history, he knows how the regulations work, he knows the machinations of the state, he knows how corrupt the agencies are, how corrupt the companies are, how corrupt local governments can be when a lot of money is thrown around, and he's willing to stand up to all these people. And so he's really emerged as one of the courageous few that I'm really trying to profile a lot. We just had an incredible victory. I'll be real quick here.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we had a website in Illinois that was for children about how wonderful coal was.
Oh, God.
And it was laughably pathetic. you know, it talked about had this little lump of coal figure as a cartoon, and he said coal no longer polluted, and we have magical clean coal now, and reclamation is the same thing as making nature even better. And basically, it was just awful, awful propaganda that I think even would make people in the coal industry cringe.
It takes a lot.
And we took years to fight this darn curriculum that was handed out to all the teachers and students. We finally got the state to do an assessment. The assessment came out and said, yeah, it's pretty awful. Let's take another 2 years to think about it. And meanwhile, they had this horrible website. And we told everybody to take that, let's get that website down. People can still access it. It's very offensive to coal miners as much as to people who live in coal mining areas. Nobody would touch it. Stan launched a petition with Credo and took off like wildfire. It shocked everybody. We got a lot of national attention. We plugged it big time, and within 14 days, the state pulled down the website.
I saw that as it happened, and that was a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and here it was that a single environmental mainstream group supported him. It was only grassroots people working with health groups and education groups and not environmental groups. And they basically were able to shame the state into doing, once again, a no-brainer. You just don't have this kind of information on a website that's paid for by public tax dollars. And I think that's what we need more of, is just people calling an ace, doing the right thing, calling people out, not in a way that...
No, we don't need Clint Eastwood music and gunfire in the streets. I mean, this is a call, Jeff, for these organizations to actually live up to their creeds and their mission statements.
Yeah, exactly.
And I took from Sam's words in your article that he is deeply frustrated because now that these four individuals you mentioned earlier sat down and collaborated in the crafting of this god-awful piece of legislation in Illinois, lo and behold, now have I got it right now that they're turning around and saying Lord, Lord, that they're wringing their hands and saying that, gosh, we didn't know it was going to be this way.
And right, they engineered this bill, and then the bill passed, and so then the Department of Natural Resources has to write up the actual rules. And they're laughable. They literally, it was written, overnight by some gas industry guy right up their hip pocket. And so here's the headline, Bob, on Sunday, the Chicago Tribune. Environmentalists feel betrayed. We're saying, you feel betrayed. And I immediately called the Chicago Tribune and said, look, there's more than just one environmentalist in Illinois. There's grassroots environmentalists, people who've been at this for decades. And to say that one group in Chicago feels betrayed is laughable. I mean, because here people have been betrayed for decades by these same people. And so to us it was just the incredible example of hypocrisy. But once again, Southern Illinois is going to pay the price, not these people.
Right. Well, no, the price is all... Well, the price is always externalized onto someone else, whether it's someone not in Chicago or someone not in San Francisco, etc. One of the things that I really appreciate about the article as you've written it, Jeff, is that, as you've noted, you don't just say this is wrong. You provide a way forward with solutions. And I think one of the most important real-world do-it-now solutions is that those four unaffected individuals who sit on the advisory panels need to step down now. And there needs to be space made for affected citizens from affected communities. Do I have that right?
Yeah, exactly. And we're saying, literally, you have a moral obligation. You've just been appointed to be the Citizen Task Force. If you truly believe in healing the wounds of the environmental community, and that's a big sort of, touchy-feely moment we have now, is we need to heal the wounds of the fracking debate. Well, if you're really serious about healing the wounds and bringing the groups together and uniting them, then you have a moral obligation to say, hey, I'm not going to serve on this task force until there's proper representation from impacted people. It's a pretty easy decision. It's the least they can do out of respect.
I'm just curious, how many of these four individuals, How many listening sessions have they held in Southern Illinois since their appointment?
Well, they just got appointed just last week, but it's, that's just it.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm getting. Okay, I probably phrased that inelegantly. How many listening sessions have they held from the time that they were collaborating in the crafting of this god-awful bill until the present instant?
Oh, I mean, you can probably count them on one hand, maybe on one finger. I would say maybe one or two of them have come down for a couple of panels and sort of told us what's happening in Springfield, the capital. And it's not really a listening session. It's mainly to come down to tell us what's going on, and this is how it's going to be, and this is what you need to do. And that's it. I mean, I think you're hitting the point there is that, you know, they haven't even come down to visit. They haven't even gone to, even more egregious to me is that these people haven't even taken the time to go visit fracking sites in other states. They haven't gone up to a frack sand mine in Wisconsin, which is, you know, hour and a half drive from us. They haven't been over to Ohio or Pennsylvania to see the mayhem. You know, they're negotiating from their little air-conditioned offices in Chicago and Springfield or Champaign-Urbana. And that, once again, is the thing that just, we've reached sort of a tipping point where we just can't take it anymore. I feel like, you know, I'm the conduit for the voices on the front lines who just say, you know, we just can't take it anymore, that these people are negotiating on our behalf. And half of them are very well-meaning, but really young people who, you know, just have no business being in this role.
And by that, may I elaborate by saying, not because they're young, but because they lack the body of experience and wisdom? Is that appropriate?
Yeah, they literally, you know, they just jumped into this issue a year and a half ago. And, you know, I think they could be working for the Cancer Society, or they could be working on gun control, or they could be working on immigration, or they could be working on whatever. This just happens to be the job they got hired to do straight out of college. And once again, they're very well-meaning, good people. But I think at a certain point, they need to have the wherewithal and the maturity. You know, they're essentially orchestrated by their national groups. And it's just to step back for a moment and realize they need to listen to the people who've been at it for years. And I think, obviously, this resonates a lot with what's happening in West Virginia.
Well, I know you've only got a little bit more time, and as usual, you're on the road from one place to another. I have real sympathy with that, Jeff. But let me ask this just as a sort of a meta question for all of this coming out of those last remarks you made. Is there a fundamental systemic flaw here insofar as what is referred to as the environmental movement is now operating on the same sort of industrial paradigm where you go to college and you major in something that winds up being like non-profit management or something like that, and you come out and you feel like you're automatically qualified to go in and tell affected communities what, you know, now see here, you people. Do you get what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the real parallel to me is the well-meaning kids who came down to West Virginia for the war on poverty and ended up becoming governors, is that, you know, they have a heart of gold, they want to do right, they're extremely articulate and well-trained, and they come out of college with that degree in some sort of administration, and they think they can change poverty overnight. They don't have a clue of the complexity, but also the decades, if not centuries, of resistance that has been fighting. And I think we know it with the poverty movement. You know, in Mingo County, I edited a book that came out, of course, that dealt with what happened there in the 60s and the 70s of well-meaning, but ultimately idealistic young poverty warriors that really became part of the problem. To people like Don West, you know, the great West Virginia poet and labor organizer who wrote an incredible pamphlet called Poverty Pays as Long as You're Not Poor. And Don really went after the same people that I think that we're having to have a reckoning with today. And it's these well-meaning outsiders who come in, who, as you say, sort of think they are trained and they know it all, and they can work the system and game the system, and they can write the grants, and they get the federal grants and the nonprofit grants, and, you know, and they either walk away after 2 years because they all get burned out, or they cut deals which they shouldn't be cutting that ultimately lead to a worse problem. And so, yeah, I think the environmental movement...
Or maybe they wind up making $250,000 a year being somebody's executive director.
Exactly. Or they go into politics or something.
Well, okay, then one final, because you do look for solutions, is it reasonable or rational or even sane to say that grassroots people around the country need to start put out a call for some sort of a reconciliation with the big greens?
Bob, I've really come to the point where I feel like, and we had a real moment last summer in Southern Illinois after the disaster of the fracking bill when it passed through, and I was there sitting in the Capitol, and when one state rep after another got up and said, I'm voting for this bill because the Sierra Club's supporting it. And then to see Sandra Steingraber, the great biologist who's a native of Illinois, who's become really the famous toxic avenger, cancer survivor, to see her stand up and scream into that chamber, you have betrayed us. You have betrayed the children of Illinois. You betrayed our health and our environment. It struck me hard.
I watched the video that you provided, and it had the same effect even at great distance.
Yeah, that Sandra was basically the mode of these old abolitionists who spoke about truth and who were fearless and courageous and called an ace an ace. And, you know, as we all know, the emancipation movement had all sorts of divisions. And I felt like what I was learning from Sandra, and I think what I've learned from history as a historian, is I'm not going to spend my time going after these people, but perhaps I need to spend my time more of finding the Sam Stearns, the Bob Kincaids, you know, the Bo Webbs, the people who are standing up and really get the voice, the focus back to the courageous people who are speaking the truth. And I think that's the role we need to play now, is to get to the funders, to get to the media. And part of my article today was to say, you know, you need to be talking to the right people and stop quoting this person when they don't represent that region, and stop appointing these people if they don't represent that region. And I feel like it's almost hopeless to keep going after these big green groups, because I feel like they're caught up in this kind of whirlpool and they're never going to get out of it. And we almost need to go around them now and create our movement. You remember what Don West said? He said in 1970, he said, if you look at the spoils of strip mining around us, we have to come to the conclusion that no one is going to save ourselves but ourselves until we make our own stand. And I think Don West knew it then in the 60s and 70s. That,
well, that's the space the AIC Act came from. That's the space that this grassroots activism in Illinois is coming from. And I think, you're right, Jeff. And the question becomes one of brainstorming the how part.
Right.
It's been a long time since you and I have sat down over a cup of coffee. I hope we can begin that discussion, because it takes place in central Appalachia. It takes place in southern Illinois. It takes place in Arizona. It takes place, it takes place with the grassroots communities that have the proposal of these god-awful Powder River Basin coal trains polluting their lives just because they happen to live near the railroad tracks. There's plenty of space open for this conversation, and maybe it is time to just go around.
Yeah, and I think, and for us to be smarter and more dynamic and more courageous, and because you know what, Bob, I think they're becoming increasingly, they play a role, they do good work, but I think they're becoming increasingly irrelevant in the bigger picture. I think at a certain point we felt we had a a certain influence on the Obama administration, and I think that was made quite clear very quickly that we don't. It's not like any of the big greens can crack the whip and get the EPA or anybody to listen to them. I think what we've realized is they don't really have that much power. You know, they're not going to save us. And you know what? I feel fine. Because I know who's going to save us. It's going to be the people on the front line who are going to stand up. And once again, that's why I'm giving a lot of attention now to people like Sam Stearns, is because he's defended our forests from the loggers, from the pesticides, from the coal miners, and now from the frackers. And, you know, I'm willing to step over that line and be with people like him and say, you know, these are the people ultimately we have to side with. And then that's exactly what you and your incredible ranks are doing in West Virginia. And people are watching, Bob. Should never feel like what you guys do is not being watched. People definitely admire just the incredible resilience and perseverance and inspiration of what you guys are doing.
So, thank you, Jeff. And thank you for everything that you do. So wherever it is you are going, go safely. And I hope we'll talk soon. And yeah, thanks again for putting this article out there this evening.
Thanks for having me on, Bob. Do great work. Take care.
You do too, Jeff. Bye now. Award-winning author and cultural historian Jeff Biggers calling from the road. You know, I read the article kind of late in the day and just dropped an email to him, and lo and behold, like 15 minutes before airtime, and lo and behold, Jeff was there even as we were rolling the intro music to get this information out. And it has, as I hope you can see, a broad application. It's not just Central Appalachia. It's not just Southern Illinois, even though there's no such thing as just Central Appalachia or just Southern Illinois or just anywhere else, because these are all magnificent communities. You know, for me to sit there in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, on Friday night, to a standing room only crowd, and they were presented. It was not about me. It is never about me. I don't want it to be about me. I don't ever want to be the person who says, "Now see here, you people," because I'm about up to my nostrils in "Now see here, you people." It's got to be the will and the desire of the communities. But there was new information to be taken about these ultrafine particulates. They want people wanted to hear it, and they went away, I think, in possession of. See how easy it is to get into eliminationist language, because I almost said armed with. No, they went away in possession of information that can be critical to their continued decent survival. Because the blasting is going on, the impacts on water are going on, and I hope at some point in time to have Dr. McCauley on here just to talk about these ultrafine particles with the Horn Family Commune, because it is information that has broad relevance. It doesn't just happen in Appalachia, or it isn't just, no. Wherever somebody wants to set off explosions in order to get at something that they want to sell for money to someone else and be damned anybody who lives near it, this stuff is relevant. And there are overarching issues regarding the EPA. You know, the EPA has particulate regulations. It's called PM10 and PM2.5. Neither of those are even remotely relevant to the issues. They're not. Just not. So, Jeff referenced having gotten in trouble here and there. Don't anybody tell the Sierra Club and NRDC and those folks that we had this conversation tonight, or somebody will call me in and tell me once more, "Bob, you can't criticize the club." I think that would be time number 6 that I've been told you can't criticize the club. You see, that's their job. Their job is to lead the stupid hillbillies. because, you know, we're not smart enough to do anything for ourselves, even though we got the first bill ever introduced that would end mountaintop removal, which they're still not supporting, which should, as Jeff Biggers says, be a no-brainer. So we have all of that to consider. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff to go into this evening because, well, I've been away from the microphone since Thursday, Friday, yesterday. And I guess we'll just have to let some of the... And there were some choice morsels in those 3 days. And we'll have to let a lot of them go by the boards, but there's some that we won't. And just to let you know, first of all, I want to extend my profound thanks to the Pinocchio Hills Education Project for getting me up there, for inviting us up there to northern Wisconsin, as well as helping provide the forum at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. I can never thank them well enough. And I hope that we... I know Dr. McCauley did a magnificent job, but I hope we did a good job of not being the now see here you people. Because coming away, I always got, it's a kind of a, let's see, on the way out, it was Charleston to Atlanta, Atlanta to Minneapolis, Minneapolis to Duluth. That was Thursday. Then Friday was drive from Duluth to Eau Claire. And then Saturday was drive from Eau Claire to Ashland. And then I had Sunday to go out into the Pinokies themselves in the company of my dear friend Bill. I got to spend a little time talking with an amazing human being, my buddy Pete. Saturday night we had a room full at Northland College in Ashland. And absolutely, one of those things I will never forget, a beautiful potluck dinner was put on for us on Saturday evening before the event at Northland College. A potluck was put on for us at on the Bad River Reservation. They brought in a magnificent drum group called the Bucks. You can find them on Facebook, THABUCKS. And it was transformative. And if you're open to the essential goodness of people just wanting to protect their homes, you can't help but be transformed, changed, moved by being even remotely included in the process. The dinner was beautiful. There was a big pot of locally gathered and processed wild rice. Mel up at the harvest camp in the Pinokies sent me away from there with two big Ziploc bags full of wild rice, and I'm sitting here practically counting out every grain, figuring out what to do, which way to, and I learned some stuff about wild rice, how to cook it, different things to do with it. None of it will soon be forgotten. I sat in a 21st century wigwam in the Pinokies and heard the song of strong winds blowing above while inside the structure that's based on 10,000-year-old construction principles. Never a breeze was felt. It was toasty warm. And it was mighty good. I got to meet with the farm family out in direct line of sight of where these people want to destroy a community in order to make themselves money, because people like Chris Klein have not yet figured out that they don't hook U-Hauls behind hearses. And the welcome was simply total and all-encompassing. I met people up there that I had not met before. I met a brilliant poet who's going to get to read his works that he writes there on the shores of Lake Superior He's going to get to read his work at City Lights Books in San Francisco. Wow. Just wow. And we got to talk a lot about the rest of the... Well, not the rest of the threat, but understanding the totality of the threat. And they were tremendous conversations. And by the way, if you go to IndianCountryTV.com, IndianCountryTV.com, there is a video that you can play at your leisure of the Ashland meeting at Northland College. IndianCountryTV.com. So that's just a little bit of an overview. Oh, by the way, and I haven't even had a chance to tell my buddies back up in northern Wisconsin this yet, they'll get a big laugh out of it. Apparently, wild rice, native gathered and native processed, is a potential security risk. Going through security, my backpack, which had my bags of wild rice tucked in the bottom of it, lit up the, and so I had to get my bag searched. And that's always a little bit nerve-wracking. I knew the most dangerous thing in there was probably a Lifesavers, because my blood sugar plummets sometimes, so I always make sure there's some kind of something in there to keep it. Yeah. And there's a tablet and a couple of fountain pens and a couple of traditional notepads, my journal, things like that. And we're going to need to search your bag, sir. Okay. Whatever makes you happy. You're the guy with the gun and the handcuffs and the badge, and I'm just little old me. Search away. Anything in this bag could potentially hurt me, sir? No. Don't think so. Pretty sure not. And then, so he goes through and then says, this appears to be, you have seeds down here or something? I've got some wild rice that my Ojibwe friends gave me. Oh, okay. That makes sense. And he looks down there. Yep, definitely wild rice. Sets it off all the time. So just, if you happen to be traveling from the Northwoods and you happen to have been given some wonderful wild rice as a gift and you tuck it into your carry-on and you're not paying $40 or something to ship it through checked baggage, don't be surprised when they pull you over and search your wild rice, because it could potentially be frightening wild rice. We are a coward people. C-O-W-E-R-E-D. We are a coward people. We are huddling in water-boweled fear of everything that goes bump in the night, and even some things that taste good with a little bit of meat and some onions and some, wild rice. Well, it's wild, isn't it? Mercy sakes. So here we come to the end of the first hour of tonight's conversation. And it is, after all, conversation radio, right? That means you play a big part in it. 304-658-3333 is the number. That's the regular old telephones. But if you want to jump in on the Skype line, that is Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. And now, not having mentioned it for, look at me, 56 minutes, I will tell you that we are badly behind in fundraising. Thank you to Sal for getting us started this evening, and thank you to Thomas for his help yesterday. And we had more help along the way over the weekend, so that the fundraising is not as terrifyingly bad as it otherwise might be. And I want to make sure that everyone does, in fact, get thanked. Some folks have subscriptions, and they have, and that makes things really convenient, I hope, on both sides of the equation. But what it boils down to is we are about, the hole is about $380 deep right now. Yeah, seriously, thanks to Sal, thanks to Khalil, thanks to Thomas. Thank you indeed, one and all. 38 folks at $10 a piece isn't too terrible a hole. Maybe we could crawl out of that. And that would put us even for beginning tomorrow evening with the usual evening's $150. So, PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. The traditional mail address is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318 Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801. Remember, checks, money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, but should in fact be made payable to Head On Communications, The Horn, something like that. And thank you, one and all, for those of you who participate either one way or the other. And without getting too full of myself, because that's not my goal, I will simply say that I'm not sure, but I bet that we here in this community we have created are one of, if not the first people to hear on a broadcast basis in a long-form conversation, Jeff Biggers talking about the giant sellout in Illinois and, what's worse, the terrific mess the smart people have made, but alongside providing some potential solutions. If one is going to raise a complaint,